From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Bob Oakes. This is On Point. President Trump yanks John Brennan's security clearance. The ex-CIA director called it an attempt to suppress criticism.
I have tried to voice the concerns of millions of Americans about Mr. Trump's failures, and this is not going to deter me at all. I'm going to continue to speak out.
Former White House aide Amarosa Manigault-Newman feuds with President Trump and releases secret recordings of White House staffers.
I'm not going to be bullied. I'm not intimidated, and I'm going to go toe-to-toe with him. Everything he throws at me, believe me, my tapes are much better than theirs.
The Queen of Soul, Aretha Franklin, died Thursday at the age of 76. Her 1968 hit, Think, became a feminist anthem. This hour on Point, it's the weekly news roundtable with Aaron Blake and On Point news analyst Jack Beattie. You can join us on air or online. What do you make of President Trump's cancellation of John Brennan's security clearance? Did your city's newspaper publish an op-ed countering President Trump's attacks on the press? What do the hundreds of editorials say about the standing of the Fourth Estate? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining us now from Washington, Aaron Blake, senior political reporter for the Washington Post. Aaron, great to have you back.
Thanks for having me.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beattie joins us. Hi, Jack.
Hello, Bob. Hello, Aaron.
So let's start with the Brennan issue. The president this week pulled the security clearance of former CIA director John Brennan and is reportedly laying the groundwork for doing the same for a dozen other top officials who are among his most vocal critics. Here's White House Press Secretary Sarah Sanders at a briefing on Wednesday reading the president's statement on revoking Brennan's clearance.
Mr. Brennan has recently leveraged his status as a former high-ranking official with access to highly sensitive information to make a series of unfounded and outrageous allegations, wild outbursts on the internet and television about this administration. Mr. Brennan's lying and recent conduct, characterized by increasingly frenzied commentary, is wholly inconsistent with access to the nation's most closely held secrets.
In an interview, Donald Trump explained part of his reasoning is that Brennan was one of the people pushing the Russia investigation. Aaron, let's start with you. What does President Trump stand to gain, do you think, by pulling this clearance?
Well, it seems to be, at the very least, an effort to push back against some of his chief critics. If you look at the list of people whose security clearances they are looking at revoking, John Brennan is actually the one who has arguably been the most out there with his commentary. He just had a New York Times op-ed in which he said that the president did indeed collude with Russia. There is evidence of collusion in this investigation right now. So the fact that they began with him, I think, makes sense because he was perhaps the easiest target for this whole thing. But it's not difficult to look at this whole thing and say that this is clearly targeted at critics from the past administration, clearly targeted at people who have been involved in this investigation at the highest levels, have been making decisions with the information that has come from this investigation, whether in this administration or the previous one. And he's now basically targeting all of them and potentially taking away one of their key prerogatives, trying to embarrass them. And so, you know, I think that the White House is certainly arguing that this is a good government thing, that this is about making sure that these officials are not, you know, having outrageous commentary, are not monetizing this access. But the fact that it's so broad and the targets are so wide ranging, I think, is making that explanation a little bit more difficult to swallow.
In a story in the Washington Post this week, Aaron, you wrote that the president or people in government under Trump have now fired or threatened to fire most of the senior officials related to the Russia probe. And you called it the White House enemies list.
Yeah, that's, of course, a throwback to the Nixon era where we found out that the President Nixon had an enemies list, which, of course, many people assumed that he did. We later found out that he actually did. This is, you know, maybe not completely analogous to that, but it is striking that there were, you know, there was one official whose clearance was revoked, but they listed nine others, and all of them were antagonistic towards the president from the past administration. These were people who clearly the commentary that they're putting forward, the things that they've done in the past, are not things that the president likes. And whether these actions are warranted or not, it's clear that this is very much targeted at the critics of President Trump.
Jack Beatty, is this a redux of the Richard Nixon enemies list?
Well, as John Dean, who was one of the people involved in putting together the enemies list for President Nixon, as he said last night on CNN, this is a step beyond the enemies list. He said President Nixon didn't do anything based on the enemies list. It was out there as a sort of target of opportunity and of presidential pique. The president has acted on it. And as John McLaughlin, the former CIA director, said yesterday, we've seen this show before. We've seen it in authoritarian regimes, in petty dictatorships, where leaders use the power of government to punish their political enemies. And, of course, the great threat of the Trump presidency is that that's how we're going to end up, in a kind of Trumpian authoritarian dictatorship. And this is a kind of early warning that that is a possibility. The president, this is a breaking of a norm, goes well beyond anything that any president has done, according to John Dean. And there's another aspect to it. Rachel Maddow reported last night that these people that she went through the list who are on it will need their security clearance to testify before any, if there was any sort of judicial outcome from the Mueller probe, they would need to be able to go into the government and get their notes. This prevents them from testifying. So, in effect, it's also a strike against potential witnesses.
Well, considering the obstruction of justice question aimed at President Trump and the administration in the Russia probe, did Donald Trump potentially deepen his legal problem with this move then, Jack?
Well, you have Lawrence Tribe tweeting that, in fact, this is obstruction of justice in plain daylight on tweet and on a Twitter, and it echoes the interview he gave to Lester Holt of NBC last year, where he said, the White House gave one reason he fired Director Comey. And he said, well, no, it was this Russia thing. I mean, that he out and out said it. And in effect, he said this about Brennan, too, the Russia thing.
If I could pick up on that point that Jack just made there about, you know, how this plays into the obstruction investigation, there is also a growing argument that some are making around the Southern District of New York, especially that this could not just play into the obstruction investigation, but could also be a potential case of what's known as witness retaliation. Not all the names on the list would be necessarily be considered witnesses in the Russia investigation, but some of them, including Sally Yates, were involved in some key events in this process, have testified to those events. And it is against the law for you to retaliate against somebody who provides information to authorities in an investigation that that you don't like. And so if this is viewed by Robert Mueller as the president potentially retaliating against these people, that could open up an entirely new front, even separate from the obstruction investigation.
You know, we all know that John Brennan almost immediately fired back, clearly not muzzled by this move, saying President Trump's claims of no collusion in the Russia investigation are hogwash, adding the only questions that remain are whether it was criminal or how many members of Trump Incorporated, quote unquote, as he put it, were involved. Kimberly Atkins of the Boston Herald, the Washington bureau chief of the Herald, joins us now. What's the risk to Trump that this move backfires, Kim, as it and that it only ratchets up the criticism? And I ask because we know that retired Admiral William McRaven, who oversaw the Osama bin Laden raid, responded as well, saying, revoke my security clearance, too. His criticism was blistering. He wrote in The Washington Post, through your actions, you have embarrassed us in the eyes of our children, humiliated us on the world stage, and the worst of all, divided us as a nation. If you think for a moment that your McCarthy-era tactics will suppress the voices of criticism, you are sadly mistaken. That from retired Admiral William McRaven. Kimberly, has the Trump move already backfired?
Yeah, it's hard to tell and depends on from whose point of view you're talking about. And clearly to the president, it hasn't. And he's never been stopped before by pushback. But as you said, there has been a really strong pushback, not just from that statement, but from a number of former defense and intelligence and securities officials who joined in a letter really denouncing this move and saying how dangerous it is to do that. Why the reason that people have these security clearances are for national security, that they can come into play, that they can be of use in the event of some future situation where they can be consulted, not just during the current administration, even if the president isn't fond of all these people, but in future administrations as well, that you need that brain trust in place to turn to, and that this is really a problematic move. But again, what we've seen with this president is when he is angry at something, when he feels personally attacked in some way, we see him react. And I think we also saw another feature of this, in that this decision was sort of kept in pocket for 3 weeks and revealed when other negative headlines were dominating about this White House. So I think we could also look to when perhaps if there's a verdict in the Manafort trial, or if Robert Mueller drops some sort of new set of indictments, we may see the president use that opportunity to start yanking security clearances of other people.
Well, if he was trying to distract us from all his other problems, it really didn't work, did it?
No, it did not.
All right, we're talking about this week's top stories. Join the conversation. What do you make of this story? What do you make of Amorosa's claims about President Trump? Did you hear her secretly recorded tapes? And what did you hear in them if you heard them? I'm Bob Oakes. This is On Point.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
Hey, this is Stretch Armstrong.
And this is Bobbito Garcia, the hosts of What's Good.
We're back with a brand new season.
We've got Erykah Badu, Lenny Kravitz, Black Thought, and more.
You'll hear B-side stories from A-list guests. Subscribe now.
This is On Point. I'm Bob Oakes. We're taking a look at this week's top headlines. Join the conversation. How would you rule in the Paul Manafort trial? What's your reaction to the grand jury report finding widespread abuse of children by Catholic priests in Pennsylvania? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. We're speaking with Kimberly Atkins, Washington Bureau Chief of the Boston Herald, Aaron Blake, Senior Political Reporter for the Washington Post, and On Point News Analyst Jack Beatty. This week, over 300 newspapers around the nation published editorials pushing back on President Trump's attack on the news media. Marjorie Pritchard, Deputy Managing Editor of the Boston Globe, spoke to NPR's Morning Edition on Thursday about the relationship between President Trump and the press.
The danger is that he is labeling the press the enemy of the American people. These are fellow citizens, and we thought it would be good to have a response from editorial pages or publications around the country to defend the press.
So as reporters, I'm curious about your take on the editorials published countering President Trump's attack. Aaron, why don't I start with you?
Yeah, so the response from the president via tweet on Thursday was that this was basically the media colluding against him. You know, the media is supposed to be studiously neutral and unbiased in its coverage, but one thing in which it's not unbiased is when it comes to press freedom. And there is an increasing clash, mostly of the president's choosing, I would argue, between the press and the president because of the rhetoric that the president uses to describe the press, because of him talking about potentially rolling back libel laws, because of him saying fake news. and because of him now increasingly talking not just about fake news, but the idea that the press is the enemy of the American people, it puts us in an uneasy situation because we don't necessarily want to be the story. There is a perception, which we're all well aware of, that the press is out to get this president. A lot of people on the right in this country believe that. And so by pressing this case and you know, forcing the media to respond to it, the president is rallying his base. And so it's a very difficult situation, but it's a tried and true one when it comes to the Republican Party that has used over the last several decades, and the president has basically weaponized it now.
Kimberly.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with everything that Aaron said. I think that one thing that people are finding some difficulty, and I'm talking not the president, but the public who has received this negatively, is that they do see these coordinated editorials as some sort of A, either bias, or B, attack on the president. And I saw them as neither. Just as the president would stand up and strongly protect Article 1 of the Constitution, because that's where the executive power is derived from, members of the press, the journalism as an industry, is the only trade that is expressly protected by the U.S. Constitution. And that's what this is, a reminder that there is a freedom of the press, and pushing against that always goes against the spirit of that rule, if not the letter. And the president's attack, just as Aaron said, as the enemy of the people. I mean, that's a really, really strong denouncement. That's, to put us in the same category as those folks who would commit terrorist attacks or something against the United States is really outrageous. And I think it's important to point that out. I don't think that's being unbiased. I think that it's an important assertion of the Constitution and its protections of journalists.
Jack Beatty, did the newspapers break new ground here in standing up for the free press, or did they dump more fuel on the fire?
Well, I can imagine that Mr. Trump will try to, make it look like fuel to the fire. But I find it interesting that among the 100 largest U.S. dailies, 57 endorsed Hillary Clinton in 2016. Two endorsed Mr. Trump. One of them, the Florida Times Union, ran an editorial in this series. That's quite noteworthy. Even a pro-Trump newspaper joined in. But Mr. Trump, I think, knows his target audience. And one of the really frightening things in the Globe editorial was they pointed out that 43% of Republicans, quote, believe the president should have the authority to close news outlets engaged in bad behavior. Well, there we're throwing over the Constitution. And 43% of Republicans would favor that? It's almost unbelievable that we've reached that this appetite for authoritarianism is so strong in the Republican Party. And I think part of it is, we have to say it, the press is ludicrously anti-Trump. I mean, Michael Kinsley, of all people, wrote it. And that's partly because Trump makes it so. If Trump weren't tweeting all the time, we wouldn't be talking about these outrageous things he says. We'd be talking about his policies. But he's always sort of feeding the media frenzy to say, oh my God, look what he said here, look what he said there. And that produces this idea, and probably this concert of editorials reinforces it, that the press is out to get the president.
Brenda is calling from Aiken, South Carolina. Hi, Brenda, go ahead.
Hi, Bob. I live in an extremely conservative Republican area. And very recently, our local newspaper, the Aiken Standard, reprinted an editorial from the Boston Globe titled, Let Trump Be Trump. So that's the background from which to evaluate the fact that the Aiken Standard signed on to that letter and wrote an editorial about why they did it. That was really remarkable to me, and I tell you, I'm in my mid-70s. I have often not agreed with what my government was doing, but I have never before been afraid for the fate of my nation. And I have been since Trump has been in office, because he has been moving us clearly toward an authoritarian state. And the fact that the Aiken Standard joined with the other newspapers gives me hope, for the first time, a glimmer of hope that there will be concerted resistance to that move toward authoritarianism.
So you are in favor of the First Amendment rights of the First Amendment rights of everybody. You're in favor of the free press. You're in favor of continued vigorous coverage of the and objective coverage of the Trump administration.
Absolutely. That is necessary. If we lose that, we've lost everything.
Brenda, thank you very much for your call. We appreciate it. Maybe with an opposing view now, we hear from Reggie, who's calling from Iowa. Hi, Reggie.
Hi, Bob. I just want to say it's kind of a false narrative being pushed that Trump said the media is the enemy of the people. His actual quote was fake news is the enemy of the people. And if you're pushing a false narrative and you're pushing propaganda, then you are the enemy. If you're being honest and going by what the press is supposed to be doing, you're not the enemy. But when every single press outlet gets offended when he says fake news, you know, it's like, what are they trying to hide? And you said, you said objective press coverage. I quit believing in objective press coverage during Desert Storm when I personally witnessed Wolf Blitzer lie on the air.
Okay, let's talk about this in the with our guest right now. Aaron, what's your take on what he's saying, on what Reggie's saying?
Right. I actually sympathize with some of what Reggie was saying. I think that there is, as with any group of people, when you're being attacked, sometimes you overinterpret things. I think that there is sometimes an overreaction to the president criticizing the press for doing things wrong, and the media saying, oh, it's an attack on the free press. It's an attack on the free press if he's talking about rolling back libel laws, if he's calling the enemy of the American people. There are legitimate press criticisms that we should not be above. At the same time, the idea that the president is only calling the fake news the enemy of the American people, he's having it both ways here. He has called most every major outlet in this country fake news. I actually ran through these a few weeks ago: CNN, MSNBC, The Washington Post, The Boston Globe, The New York Times. Basically, all the major outlets from where people get their information have been labeled fake news by the president. So he may say it's just fake news, but that's a category in which he has shoved the vast majority of national outlets in this country. And so he's basically labeled all of them the enemy of the American people. So we can parse this and we can, you know, parse the comments. But his effort is clearly aimed at sowing broader distrust in the entire mainstream media. And I think to pretend that it's anything else is to not really recognize what he's saying.
Jack Beatty, last word on this, if you would. Does this flap this week change anything?
Well, I think it gives the president something to run against. He'll cite, you know, for years Republicans have attacked the media. He now says it is the opposition, he's going to attack as much as he can, and increasingly he's going to ask his followers to step with him into the world of sort of abracadabra. He says, just stick with us. Don't believe the crap you see from these people, the fake news. Just remember, what you're seeing and what you're reading is not what's happening. Believe me, not your lying eyes. This is...
Okay, I think we just lost Jack there. Let's move on to Omarosa. Former reality TV star Omarosa Manigault Newman, fired by Donald Trump from his show The Apprentice, fired from her job as a White House aide, now on a book tour on her time in the White House that's clearly gotten President Trump, under President Trump's skin, especially because of the tapes she secretly recorded of her firing and others that she's now releasing. She says a recording she released to MSNBC on Thursday shows the administration tried to buy her silence shortly after her ousting. In the recording, Trump campaign official and family member Lara Trump appears to offer Manigault Newman a $15,000 monthly salary as long as she doesn't speak negatively about the president to the media.
It sounds a little like, obviously, that there's something you've got in the back pocket to pull out. Clearly, if you come over with the campaign, like, we can't have, we gotta,
oh, God, no.
Everybody's positive, right?
Kim, who's gotten the better of this media scrum so far? The name-calling President Trump or Omarosa, who certainly learned how to manipulate and wield the media under Donald Trump?
Yeah, I think the jury is still out on that. I mean, one thing that we have seen is that Omarosa, whatever you think about her or her credibility, has shown that she is not intimidated by President Trump, that she can take his attacks that he's lobbing right back at her and fire back. One source that I was talking to last night said the reason that Omarosa has clearly gotten under the president's skin is she's somebody who fights like he does. She understands him. They're both from this background that's a combination of politics and reality TV and clawing yourself to get ahead. And they're both punchers and counterpunchers. And so in that sense, at least in this public battle, it seems that Donald Trump has met his match here the same way as someone like Michael Avenatti is able to get under his skin, because he has that same sort of punchy approach to going after the president. I think one thing we're going to see is that Omarosa is not going away anytime soon. So long as she has enough tapes to drop over a period of time, probably leading up to her, whichever the juiciest one is that she'll save for a virtual finale to this crusade in true reality television style, she's not going to go away. And as long as she's doing this, it's going to remain a problem in the White House, really causing more chaos in an already chaotic situation there.
Well, she's pretty much said that. She said she's not going away. She's not going to be bullied. She's not going to be intimidated. She's ready to go toe-to-toe. And as you point out, she's got more tapes. Do you find Omarosa credible, Kimberly? Do you think she should be believed?
I think it is reasonable, the people who point out that she does have credibility problems. We know that she was effusive with her praise for Donald Trump until she was on his bad side and got fired, and now she is doing the exact opposite. But she has shown evidence of some of the things she claimed. She claimed that the Trump campaign tried to quiet her after she was fired from the White House by offering her hush money and a non-disclosure. The president pretty much said that acknowledged the existence of non-disclosure agreements, and now she has this tape with Lara Trump that confirms the offer of money. So far what she has said has been backed up by tapes, but at the same time, so far what she has said or claimed, the president says bad things about people of color in private. Well, we've seen him do it publicly and on his Twitter feed. The president is trying to use hush money to quiet people. Well, these are allegations that have come up before. These aren't things that are unbelievable. I think it depends on whatever else she has evidence of. That'll be the final arbiter of whether or not she is seen as a credible source.
How about that, Aaron? Politico reported this week that White House staffers are afraid of what tapes come next from Omarosa. I know we're only speculating, but do you think they have reason to worry, especially if there's that tape of Donald Trump using the N-word? How explosive would that be?
Yeah, you've got to look at the timeline here. When the first tape came out last weekend, it was her being fired by John Kelly. It was perhaps understandable that she would record something when she felt like she was going to be pushed out and she wanted to embarrass some people. And then she produced a tape that was from way back during the 2016 campaign, where she was on the recording talking to other campaign aides about this idea that there was a tape out there in which the president had said the N-word. Why did she keep that tape? Was she recording things all along with an eye towards potentially using them in the future? If I were a Trump campaign aide, if I were a White House staffer, given that span of all the way from the campaign until now, you have to wonder how much else she was recording.
Give me a sentence on this, Aaron. What's the impact of all of this on the fall campaign, or is it too early to tell?
Too early to tell. I think that, like Kim said, nothing is too surprising at this point, but she might have more to come.
We're discussing the week in the news. In the next segment, we pay tribute to Aretha Franklin, who passed away at the age of 76. Join the conversation. What candidates are gaining ground in the midterm elections where you are? What questions do you have for Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh? I'm Bob Oakes. This is On Point.
So you just woke up. And you want to find out about the latest news? That is when you turn to Up First, the 10-minute news podcast from NPR News. Hear Up First on the NPR One app or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Bob Oakes. In other news this week, a catastrophic bridge collapse in Genoa, Italy on Tuesday killed at least 38 people in a Facebook video onlooker Davide DiGiorgio. He's screaming, "Oh God." Students at Stoneman Douglas High School in Florida returned to school this week, 6 months after the deadly Parkland shooting. Survivor Jacqueline Corin told CBS more security at the school will not make her feel safer.
Until we actually remove these weapons of war from our streets, we're not going to feel safe. We can have all the security we want. We can have bulletproof backpacks for all I care.
And Crazy Rich Asians hit the theaters this week. It's the first studio movie in 25 years to feature a predominantly Asian cast.
These people aren't just rich, they're crazy rich.
Well, you really should have told me that you're like the Prince William of Asia.
That's ridiculous. Much more of a Harry.
Join the conversation. Do you remember Aretha? What did her music mean to you? We'll talk about that in a few minutes. Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. We're speaking with Kimberly Atkins, Washington Bureau Chief of the Boston Herald, Aaron Blake, Senior Political Reporter for the Washington Post, and On Point News Analyst Jack Beatty. Let's talk about the Manafort trial. The federal jury now has the case and is deliberating the fate of former Trump campaign chair Paul Manafort in his bank and tax fraud trial. A verdict could come at any time. His defense team rested its case on Wednesday without calling any witnesses to the stand, with defense attorney Kevin Downing claiming the prosecution had not met the legal bar needed to prove its case against his client.
Mr. Manafort just rested his case, and he did so because he and his legal team believe that the government has not met its burden of proof.
Yesterday, the jury had questions for the judge. They apparently asked for a bigger room to spread out to look at the evidence. They asked the judge for a definition of reasonable doubt. His defense team has implied that if the jury wants to know more about reasonable doubt, that's good for them. Aaron, I'm wondering, what's your take? Is there anything we could read into that?
It's always really difficult to read the tea leaves on these jury questions, on the lengths of deliberations. Certainly, the longer this drags on, the more there will be chatter about whether this is not going to go as everybody would expected, which is that Paul Manafort would be convicted. I think the question with the four questions that were submitted by the jury is whether this is a reflection of them being, you know, uncertain about the foreign lobbying charges, but certain about the tax charges, or whether they've basically moved beyond the tax charges, because the questions had to do with the what's known as FBAR, which is the foreign lobbying disclosures that Paul Manafort had to make. It's one of many, many counts in this case. And so, you know, is there a one holdout? Are there a couple holdouts? Are they all kind of deadlocked over this whole thing right now? Or is this simply a reflection of the fact that there are lots and lots of counts to sort through, lots and lots of arcane laws to deal with here? And these are, after all, not lawyers who are dealing with all of it.
What was behind the defense move to not present any witnesses and not have Manafort take the stand?
This is actually not all that uncommon of a strategy. The defense is still allowed to set forward their case via cross-examination. It's not like they're just being silent during the entire case. Sometimes this is done because they don't want it to be conspicuous that they are not putting their own client on the stand to answer for these things. Sometimes it's a reflection, of course, of the fact that they just don't have much of a defense to offer. You know, it could be any number of things, but I think I liken this to actually taking the Fifth Amendment. You know, people look at that and say, well, you don't take the Fifth unless you're guilty. Well, there are a lot of reasons you might take the Fifth Amendment, and you can't just, you know, zero in on one possible explanation and say that that's definitely what just happened.
Kimberly, after 10 days, 27 witnesses, and many, 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 many documents the prosecution rested, did it make its case?
I think one thing that we saw from this trial is just how meticulous and document-driven the Mueller investigation is, at least with respect to Paul Manafort. And I think that we can surmise that that is how it's conducting this entire investigation. Mueller is not just relying on witnesses as much intrigue surrounding, you know, whether or not who may cooperate or who he's interviewed. The interviews are a small part of this, or even whether or not the president will sit for an interview. Everyone who is questioned in this case, it's highly likely that these investigators know the answer to the questions they're going to be asked before they are asked. And we saw this very strong documentation behind this trial. There's going to be more than twice as many documents introduced in the next trial that's coming up of Paul Manafort in D.C. So I think you see a really meticulous job here. And that should be of concern to anybody who has committed any wrongdoing surrounding all of this. And with respect to the jury, look, I remember practicing law litigation, and sometimes you'd hear a juror ask a question, and you think, oh no, we're doomed, and it turned out to be favorable. Sometimes you get very excited by the questions that jurors ask, and then in the end, you end up losing. So I think it's really tough to draw any conclusions. It sounds like they're taking their job seriously, and they're looking at everything very carefully.
Jack Beatty, how nervous should the White House be over this coming verdict? And on the flip side, if Robert Mueller loses this case, how big a blow is it to him?
That's a big blow, and the White House will make everything of it. One expert I was watching last night said that the two imponderables here are Mr. Gates and the judge. And this lawyer was saying it might have been a mistake to put so mottled a character as Rick Gates on the stand. Because you can cross-examine, as he was quite successfully a witness, you can't cross-examine documents. And the government may really have made a mistake there. And secondly, the judge. He's shown animus toward the prosecution, and I've heard attorneys say, well, that can sometimes be a signal to the jury there's something wrong with this case.
All right. On to the story that for many, many people was the most disturbing story of the week, the Catholic Church priest sex abuse scandal in Pennsylvania. Grand jury reports over 1,000 children abused over decades by hundreds of priests. At a news conference on Tuesday, Pennsylvania Attorney General Josh Shapiro said church officials in Pennsylvania systematically covered up the abuse of children.
To make it easier to target their victims, the priests gave their favored boys gifts, gold crosses to wear as necklaces. The crosses were markings of which boys had been groomed for abuse.
They manufactured pornography. They targeted children they thought were vulnerable for passing around to other priests. It's just so disturbing, Aaron.
It really is. This is one of the most, if not the most extensive reports that we've seen in a long time on this. One thing that struck me about this whole thing was it's not just focused on one diocese. It's across six of the state's dioceses in Allentown, in Erie, in Greensburg, Harrisburg, Pittsburgh, Scranton. That's across the entire state here. That's from the very southwestern part to the very northeastern part. 1,000 children, 300 Catholic priests. This is a scandal. This is a a report that's going to lead to questions about whether this is one of 50 states in which this has happened. And that's not unreasonable given how widespread it was across the entire state, according to this report.
Kate is calling from Annapolis, Maryland. Hi, Kate. Go ahead.
Hi, Bob. Well, first, I just want to thank you for covering this story. I am, like all of you, so disturbed about the thousands of children's lives that were decimated by the Catholic Church's, you know, systematic cover-up and jockeying of these pedophiles within Pennsylvania. We know it's within Massachusetts, and I grew up Catholic in New York, and I know that's coming next, and we know it's in Chile, and we can go down the list of countries across the world. And, you know, I just think this is the biggest story going, because this is, and it's not getting a lot of airplay where I am here, maybe because we're not in Pennsylvania. But I think it's about time that all of us as Catholics look and say, you know, that we have coddled these men for too long, that this male hierarchy, misogynistic organization called the Catholic Church, which I grew up loving, has failed the most basic tenet of WWJD, what would Jesus do? And that we need to say to Pope Francis, the College of Cardinals, bishops, monsignors, all of the hierarchy, you're done leading. You cannot lead any longer. We need women to lead. We need the sisters, the nuns, to take over, as far as I'm concerned. Let Mary, and let people who really understand what it is to have a family and a child and to do something like this to a child, it's just so depraved, and
Kate,
the indifference of the church.
Kate, I have to ask, are you still going to church?
I'm very sorry, but I am not. But I will always be a Catholic. I will always be a Catholic. That is where I got my grounding in social justice, in morals. The people who I love most and are dearest to my heart were Roman Catholic. The things I celebrated, first communions, baptisms, confirmations, weddings, funerals, this is who I am. But I can't be a participant in that organization.
Kate, thank you very much. Appreciate your call. As she pointed out, in a way that after being silent for a couple of days, the Vatican released a statement expressing shame and sorrow, saying the Pope is on their side, the side of victims. But Jack Beattie, don't you think it's going to feel like a little too late, too little and a little too late for many Catholics?
Yes, and there was a hedge in that statement, and I'll quote it to you. This is from the Vatican, by finding almost no cases after 2002, the grand jury's conclusion are consistent with studies showing the Catholic reforms and the church reforms in the U.S. diocese drastically reduced the incidence of clergy child abuse. Well, as Tom Gelton pointed out, the religion reporter for NPR last night, child abuse doesn't come, we don't hear about it until years later. And a letter to the editor from a psychologist in the Times echoes that. Out of fear, most individuals who are abused in childhood do not report their abusers for many years. So here's the church being complacent. Well, we haven't heard anything since 2002. And here are experts saying, wait a minute, child abuse is something you hear about years later. And secondly, the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania has come out with a list of reforms, including making the church, extending the statute of limitations and making the church liable for suit from some of these people. And this is being opposed right now by the bishops in Pennsylvania. It doesn't sound like much of a reform there.
Jack Beattie, thanks a lot for that. Let's go out by talking about the passing of a great this week, 76-year-old Queen of Soul, Aretha Franklin. Kim, you're from Detroit, Michigan, Aretha Franklin's longtime home. What does Aretha represent for the city of Detroit?
Yeah, you know, I tweeted yesterday that I know that the world is mourning the loss of this icon, this great talent. But for people in Detroit, it feels like a member of the family. You know, everybody knows where her father, C.L. Franklin's church is in Detroit and the neighborhood where she lives. She chose to stay there. A lot of the stars that came from the city in the 60s and 70s, they moved off to Los Angeles or New York, somewhere else. Aretha really became an ambassador for the city of Detroit and the people there. So it is deeply personal, not just the loss of her music, but the loss of her voice. She was an icon for civil rights, for women's rights. She just transcended the power of the amazing power of her voice. She used it for so much more than music, and her loss was really palpable.
Here's Aretha in a 1999 interview with the public radio program Fresh Air, describing the larger social and cultural resonance of her signature song, Respect.
In later times, it was picked up as a battle cry by the civil rights movement. But when I recorded it, it was pretty much a male-female kind of thing, and more in a general sense from person to person. I'm going to give you respect, and I'd like to have that respect back, or I expect respect to be given back.
Kimberly Atkins, what memories do you have of Aretha?
I mean, just her music is the soundtrack of all of our lives. And just when it comes to that song alone, it's truly amazing that she took the song written by Otis Redding, Respect, which really had a lot of misogynistic overtones when he wrote and recorded it. You know, basically, woman, when I get home from work, you better respect me. Completely flipped it, rearranged it, and turned it into a song about empowerment. You know, you will respect me as a woman, as a person. And that's why it was so easily used as a battle cry for civil rights, for women's rights. And Aretha, I think she's being a little modest there. She understood that moment. She said in another interview, it was the right song for the right moment. I think she understood what she was doing in that. And I think that's the one thing that all of us think about, particularly people from Detroit, but particularly people in the Black community, that she stood up in a time, even when it wasn't popular, supporting Martin Luther King after he gave his support or his opposition to the Vietnam War, and that wasn't popular. She was willing to take an unpopular stance for what she thought was right, and that's what we all really appreciated about her.
Kimberly Atkins of the Boston Herald, thank you very much. Same to Aaron Blake, senior political reporter for the Washington Post, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. Continue the conversation with the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Let's go out with a little respect.